Working now. Yay. Thank you, Brian. I know you got my back up there. I tell you what, I remember when Brian obeyed the gospel. That was a great day, wasn't it, Brian? Great day. I remember when several obeyed the gospel when we were teaching the Fishers of Men class. And boy, that was a great time. Great time. I know that y'all continue having those great events that occur. I bring you greetings from your sister congregation in Madison, Alabama, outside of Huntsville, Alabama. Wonderful, wonderful folks up there. We've got about 1,000 folks worshiping with us. All of them working hard and diligent at it. We've got a great group of eldership. Reminds me a lot of this congregation right here. The fellowship, the family environment that is taking place up there. And I know a lot of you have relatives up there at the Madison congregation, so I have to keep a special eye on them for you. Brother Harold Taylor, his son is up there with us. And Brother Harold says, I knew Kyle when he was about that tall. And I said, now you can say you know him when he's about this wide. And so we've had a great time with Billy Camp, a young man that I understand that's going to be here worshiping with y'all. Fantastic young man. Love him to death. Great guy to work with your singles and with your ministry here. We also have a young man that we are sending your way, and I saw him here just a few moments ago, Devin Morris. He is starting college at Faulkner, so keep a good eye on Devin for us. Great young man. He was involved with the Lads to Leaders debate team, the first debate team that I coached there, and phenomenal young man. Phenomenal young man. So we share a lot in common, and it is our pleasure to have those that have been raised at Madison share with you here, as well as you sending your relatives to us up there. This evening, I've chosen a difficult topic, but I think that's one that's near and dear to most of us. One that affects me quite often, and I thought that if it affects me quite often, maybe it affects someone else just as often as it does me. Criticism. And I'm not talking about criticism that you receive, because we all receive criticism from time to time. The lesson I have for us this evening is delivering criticism. And in certain ways that may not be as healthy, or we know that's not healthy for us to do. Picture this guy. His name is Bob. He gets up in the morning, and he gets up a little bit later than normally because his boss had asked him to finish a project that was due that day. Of course, Bob waits to the last minute, as always. So he stays up till like 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning to complete the task. He wakes up 30 to 40 minutes late in the morning, and his wife pokes him and says, "You're late, Bob," and he jumps out of bed and he runs into the bathroom to grab his toothbrush, and as soon as he grabs his toothbrush, it drops on the floor, and boy, he knows it's going to be a bad day. So he's looking around, and he finally picks up his razor, runs that razor across his face, and it cuts him nine ways to Sunday. And he figures out, I've had my wife and my daughter use my razor to shave their legs, and now I'm really in a bind. He jumps in the shower, and he notices the shampoo that was always there is no longer in the shower with him, that one of his other kids had taken the shampoo out of the shower to go use in their bathroom, and now he is without shampoo. Sound familiar? You get to the kitchen, you're ready for the bowl of Captain Crunch cereal. You pour that Captain Crunch cereal in the bowl, and there is no milk. And you look on the refrigerator, and there's the list of items that the wife has to go to the grocery store to get. Top on the list, razors. Second on the list, milk. You get out in the car and you crank up your car and you back out of the driveway. Now you're at the time when the bus runs to pick up the kids for school. And you remember the argument that you had with your wife several years ago before purchasing the home. We should live at the front of the neighborhood. Wife says, no, let's live in the back of the neighborhood. I feel much safer on a cul-de-sac. And he's remembering those conversations as he's waiting at every 25 feet for the bus to pick up the next kid at living at the next house. And he's sitting there wondering, why in the world can they not all gather and meet at one place at the front of the neighborhood? He finally gets on the road, and only to find out that he is now looking at an empty tank and the light flashing on his dash. So now he has to make a decision. Do I stop and get gas? Do I keep going? He finally stops, pulls over. He says, well, it's better to wait, let all the traffic go by, and I'm going to get gas. He gets gas, gets back on the road. And lo and behold, he enters on the express, and he notices this little red car with this young whippersnapper driving this car, and he pulls up next to him and pulls out in front, and Bob pulls over to, in the passing lane behind him, and the guy looks in his rearview mirror and stomps on the brakes, you know, and then somebody comes up right behind Bob riding his back bumper, you know, pushing him along and blowing his horn, and Bob is just not having a good day. He gets to work, and he sees all the eyes looking at him. And all the eyes, he knows, you know, that the boss wants to see him. He goes up there to the boss's office, and the boss says, well, where's my report? Well, it's right. And Bob remembers he left it at home. It's just not a good day. Bob gets back in his car at the end of the day. He gets home. And then his wife greets him and says, I went to the grocery store today. And Bob says, well, I sure hope you got razors. Well, you know I did, Bob. You know, it was on my list. I don't forget everything. Well, I hope you got milk too. Well, I got that too, Bob. Well, you know, it just I just can't believe that you couldn't get that earlier. And on it goes. The night rolls in. The kids hear mom and dad arguing. They're fussing and fighting about some little something that just gets under each other's skin. They go to bed. They wake up the next morning to start the same scenario over and over again. Tough. It's tough. What is it that helps us not live in that type of cycle of life? Well, first, I think we have to identify the problem. The problem that I would see, and the one I'm going to hinge on my lesson on this evening, is criticism. Criticism. You know how it starts. You wake up in a bad mood, and then all of a sudden, when someone says something to you, you snap back, right? And then it moves forward from there, and then criticism just kind of becomes bigger and bigger and bigger until you find yourself full-blown negative. Have you ever been there? I've been there. Sometimes I don't want to start my day being negative, but it just seems to go that way. It just seems to flow that way. And step by step, I just lower myself further and further down into this pit until I get to full-blown negative. Okay, now I'm thinking of all the people that I don't like. I remember when someone said something to me, and I know what they meant. They were trying to be nice to me, but really they weren't. You know, and when you get to that point, it's just hard to lift yourself back up out of it, isn't it? It's not a place that you meant to get, but it's a place that kind of drags you down little by little, and it's very difficult to come out of that. These little things that happen in our lives build up for an expectation of failure. You know, when you start your day and you go to school or you go to work and you start the day in a critical attitude, what should you expect? You should expect bad things. And so that's how it happens. I start a day and something rubs me the wrong way, and then something else follows that, and it just builds and builds from there. I get to a place where I don't want to be, but I can't find myself getting out of that state of critical attitude. And it's hard. It makes the days hard when we keep doing that. I had a little boy one time, years ago, when I first was trying my preacher leg, so to speak, and doing these lessons. And of course, I would do lessons like I would cross-examination, or I would do lessons like I would do examination on a witness stand, or do like a closing argument. You know, I just wax the elephant really good. And this one boy, Seth, comes up to me. He's like 5 years old, and he comes up to me, and I said, "Well, how'd you like my lesson?" And Seth says, "Well, my mama says you're verbose." And I said, "Okay." I had to go home, and I asked Jamie, "What does verbose mean?" She says, "Very wordy." "You use too much words." And I got to thinking, well, that little Seth, how'd he know a word like that? I bet you his mom and dad were talking at home. And I bet you they were talking about me. And I bet you they didn't even like my lesson. And on and on, my mind started to stir. But you know, that little boy brought me the best words of criticism that I have ever had. It changed the way I approach things. And so criticism is a learned attitude. It's a learned response that we have. Tonight I want to touch on three facts of criticism, and then I want to touch on three facts of how to identify it, and then three practical ways to control you. So it's a three-point sermon, yeah, but 9 points. So here we go. Let's look first at Numbers chapter 12. Numbers chapter 12. And here is a great example of criticism found in Scripture. And it's between some of the most well-known people of the Old Testament. Numbers chapter 12, beginning in verse 1. Miriam and Aaron. Who is Miriam and Aaron? They're Moses' brother and sister. And Miriam was the one that lowered Moses down in the water in the basket and stood off to the side and watched over her brother. Well, Aaron was the brother of Moses and became the first high priest after the Levitical order. And so here's Miriam and Aaron spoke against Moses because of the Cushite woman whom he had married. All right, now they are upset because Moses has taken for himself a woman not of their tribe. And so what do? They go and confront Moses and tell him, "Hey, we just don't agree with you." That's not what they do. What is it that they do? It says that Miriam and Moses spoke against Moses because of the Cushite woman. It means they didn't address the problem with Moses, but what they did was they used it as something that got under their skin, and they were going to be critical of him. And that's what happens. Notice he goes on, and had married the Cushite woman, and they said, "Has the Lord indeed spoken only through Moses? Has he not spoken through us also?" You see, they don't even mention the issue about the Cushite woman, do they? They go right to an issue regarding Moses and his relationship to God and their place in this matter. And he says, has he not also spoken through us? And the Lord heard it. And now the man of Moses was very meek, more than all the people who were on the face of the earth. Now, hold a little bracket right there, because we're going to come back to that. Why do you suppose that phrase was written right in the midst of all this that's going on? It's like a footnote, but here it is in the text. Now, a man, Moses, was very meek, more than all the people who were on the face of the earth. And suddenly the Lord said to Moses and to Aaron and Miriam, "Come out, you three, to the tent of meeting." And the three of them came out, and the Lord came down in a pillar of cloud and stood at the entrance of the tent and called Aaron and Miriam. And they both came forward, and he said, "Hear my words. If there is a prophet among you, I, the Lord, make myself known to him in a vision. I speak with him in a dream, but not so with my servant Moses, for he is faithful in all his house. With him I speak mouth to mouth, clearly, and not in riddles, and behold, and he beholds the form of the Lord. And why then were you not afraid to speak against my servant Moses? And the anger of the Lord was kindled against them, and he departed. When the cloud removed from over the tent, behold, Miriam was leprous, like snow. And Aaron turned toward Miriam, and behold, she was leprous. And Aaron came to Moses and said, O my Lord, do not punish us, because we have done foolishly, and we have what? Sinned. What does Aaron recognize criticism against Moses to be? Sin. Foolishness. Let her not be as one dead, whose flesh is half eaten away when he comes out of his mother's womb. And Moses cried to the Lord, O God, please heal her, please. But the Lord said to Moses, if her father had spit in her face, she would not be ashamed for 7 days. Let her be shut outside the camp for 7 days, and after that she may be brought in again. So Miriam was shut outside the camp for 7 days, and the people did not set out on the march until Miriam was brought in again. After that, the people set out from Hazeroth and camped in the wilderness of Paran. All right, so here is the situation. They were upset with Moses. And instead of addressing the issue with Moses, they began this talk. And they started criticizing Moses in this fashion. Moses ain't all that great. You know, God speaks through Moses, but he also speaks through us. Are we not as good as Moses is? In a way, that was a criticism. That was the criticism against Moses and his walk. And so, from this, notice also that when they criticized, God immediately responds. And what does God say to them? He says, "Why then were you not afraid to speak against my servant Moses? You know, I would be trembling in my boots." Wouldn't you? Here, if I had said something against Moses and God comes down to me and says, this is Moses whom I speak face to face to. How dare you say something against Moses? I'd be trembling in my boots. And so here was Aaron and Miriam in that situation. And as a result of their action, Miriam was struck as being a leper. She was made to be an outcast of that area. And so let's look at three facts concerning this act of criticism regarding Moses. Number one. A critical spirit will show itself first among those who you are closest to. Miriam, Moses, and Aaron were all part of the same family. They were brothers and sisters, and two of them ganged up on the other one. And so here, the critical spirit shows that it will first be seen among those that you're closest to, among spouse. Among parents and children. Here Moses and Miriam were of the same household, but their actions, their criticism, was bringing divisiveness in the family. I bet you could probably name a time or two in which you've seen this in your own home. How certain criticisms, unjust statements that was made out of pride, out of self-preservation, if you will, that lended itself to a divisive manner taken in a home, and how that divisive manner then grew and continued. I have three girls. They fight over the front seat of the car. My 14-year-old, love her to death. Notice you got to say, bless their heart, you know. She loves to sit in the front seat, and when her younger sister calls out, shotgun, before we run out to the car, it just gets all over her. So she sits in the back seat, sulking. Don't tell Jessica I say this, okay? She sulks, and then comes, Shannon says, well, can I listen to my MP3 player with the auxiliary cord? And sure, Shannon, I was going to ask for that. And then it starts. Well, you just give Shannon everything that she wants. You like her more than you like me. You never listen to me. And on it goes. Criticism starts with little things, and it just continues, and it becomes a divisive manner until suddenly I have to put my foot down at some point. Parents, are you there? Yeah. Children mimic what they see in others. There it goes back to you. Children will mimic what they see in others, and they will continue to do it unless they are instructed otherwise. How do you know if you have a critical spirit like that? How do you know? I want you to look at the way you speak. Look at the way that you speak in front of your children. Notice how you speak to those that are close to you. Not only does it manifest itself in front of others, but it manifests itself towards them as well. And so we have to be careful of what we speak. Here in this situation, Miriam and Aaron spoke against Moses, and it caused a beginning of division, and also went even further than that. It spreads to others, and it brings discouragement. We note that from the Hebrew letters here that it is gender specific as to who started this statement. It was Miriam. It was Miriam, and then it spread to Aaron, and then it would spread to others if God hadn't put an end to it. One person badmouths the boss at work. What happens when that occurs? Usually others don't want to be left out, and so, well, yeah, I remember him doing something bad to me like that before. And it starts and it begins to roll and it continues to roll until it gets the whole office in an uproar against the boss. And the next thing you know, there's a movement to oust the boss. And over a critical attitude or a critical spirit that someone had started, soon you have the whole place against one person who may have been an innocent bystander in the whole affair. A critical spirit leaves a wave of destruction. There are six things, in fact, seven things, that the Lord finds detestable. And all of these are connected with the spreading of a critical attitude. Listen to the seven and see if you can identify them. Arrogant eyes. One that thinks themselves more highly than what they ought. A lying tongue. Well, I know this is what he meant to say, and I know that he meant it for bad for me, and so I'm going to say it to someone else. Hands that shed innocent blood. A heart that plots wicked schemes. Feet eager to run to evil. A lying witness who gives false testimony. One who stirs up trouble among the brothers. If you look at the root cause of all these, I think you will find them very close to having a critical spirit deep-seated in them. Remember Jesus said as recorded by Matthew in Matthew 12, verse 36. We will be held accountable for what? Every idle word that we speak. No matter how big or how strong of a Christian you may think that yourself to be, you need to be on guard of a critical spirit because it will show itself to others. Numbers 12 and verse 2, "Hath not God spoken unto us as well? Up to this point, Miriam had done a lot of wonderful and great things. She had placed Moses in a basket, cared for him down by the river. She had called for her mom at the proper time to have her mom go and take care of Moses. In Exodus chapter 15, we see a song of rejoicing after crossing the Red Sea. Those words were Miriam's words. But here we see her struggle, a struggle with a sense of pride, maybe even a sense of arrogance, and wanting to do harm to her brother. It doesn't matter how long you've been a Christian, you can still fall and succumb to the temptation of a critical spirit. 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 12 says, "Take heed lest you fall." We can say, "Well, I don't do big sins." But realize that criticism in this fashion, Aaron said, was a sin. Moses was getting all the glory, and their pride had gone to their hearts and caused them to speak this evil against Moses. Was Moses innocent? Remember the footnote. And Moses was meek, very meek, more than all the people who were on the face of the earth. Why is that there? It's to remind the reader that the innocence also suffers as the result of a critical attitude. And so nobody will escape critical words or critical thoughts. Moses was innocent. He did not deserve the criticism, no matter how good you may be in this world, and no matter how low to the ground that you fly to try to escape criticism, it will always touch you in some form or fashion. Notice Jesus, the sinless man, sinless God who walked upon this face of this earth, and he did nothing wrong. And yet he suffered criticism at every turn. It's an ugly picture of criticism, and it even shows how criticism put Jesus upon that cross and crucified him. Preachers are not immune to criticism. And many will succumb to criticizing a preacher in such a fashion that they do not deserve it. Many preachers move on from place to place because of that very fact. Y'all have got a great man here, Brother Doug Smith. Wonderful gospel preacher. Hold him up. Hold him up and let him preach the words of the Bible and encourage one another as you see Brother Doug presenting lessons from the pulpit. When you see a person teaching a Bible class, don't succumb to the temptation in saying, "Well, I probably could have said it better," or "Why isn't Brother so-and-so teaching this class?" Oh, you lift them up. You encourage them and you continue. Don't let criticism divide and be a divisive tool among the brotherhood. Point number three, criticism will not go unpunished. You notice here with Miriam, she was struck with leprosy. And in a spiritual sense, we're not struck with physical leprosy today, but when we let a little bit of a critical attitude start eating away at our souls, and we find this little black speck in our hearts, that black speck of criticism will do what? It'll grow. It'll take you over. It'll take your whole soul over into a black abyss. You never wanted to start, or you never wanted to go there. Three ways to identify criticism. All right, look at 1 Corinthians chapter 13 and verse 5. The love chapter. 1 Corinthians 13, 1 through 5. All right, ready. Number one, how do you identify it? "If I speak with the tongues of men and of angels, but hath not love, I'm a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal." No matter how pretty or how flowery your words may be, if you're saying something and it's void of love, it's critical. When we say the phrase, bless his heart, and then we follow it with some biting word of sarcasm or critical thought, don't think that the words bless his heart covers up the harm that's being done. Don't be critical. Don't say something in a pretty tone just because it may sound good to the person, but you really don't mean it in your heart. You know, these are the types of statements that people will say jokingly most of the time, won't they? They'd say something jokingly about you, and then when you get in the car and you're driving away from meeting them, and you're halfway home, you think, oh, wait a minute. Did they really mean this, or did they really mean that? Don't be caught up in that. If you love someone, say it straightforward. Don't say things out of flowery speech just to win their approval than to hide your true feelings. Verse number 2. And if I have prophetic powers and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have all faith so as to move mountains, but I have not love, I am nothing. Here's a way to identify it. No matter how truthful your words may be, if they are spoken void of love, they are critical. We don't gossip, do we? But if it's the truth, we will spill our guts. And sometimes that is void of love. Just because something is true doesn't necessarily mean that you have to share it with other people. Sometimes you know the times that you can share things. And you do it out of love and out of concern. Point number 3. If I give away all that I have, and if I deliver up my body to be burned, but have not love, I gain nothing. If what you do does not agree with what I think about you, then it's a critical spirit. What do I mean? Children. When your mom or your dad says something to you, oh yeah, yeah, I'll go take that care of that, and you run to your room to do whatever the mom or dad says, and then behind the door you're thinking and you're saying, I don't want to do this, I hate doing this, my mom, and gritting your teeth and you're doing it, and then when your mom, what are you saying? Oh, nothing. It's a critical attitude. Why? Because what's in your heart is not being shown or put forth by your actions. And so you have to be careful of that. Make sure that your heart mimics, or your actions mimics what's in your heart. And if it comes out wrongly, then you know it is a critical attitude. 3 ways to conquer it. Verse number 4 and 5. Love is patient and kind. Love does not envy or boast. It's not arrogant or rude. It does not insist on its own way. It is not irritable or resentful. What do we gain from those passages? Let minor issues go. Leave minor issues to be minor issues. Love will overlook the petty things of life. You know how much easier it is to live a life when you overlook some of the greatest things? I mean, some of the minor irritations of life. Your marriage will go so much easier. Your children will be so much happier. Children, you will be so much happier towards your parents. Let the minor things go and let them stay minor. Love overlooks the little insignificant things of life. You know, we have little things. We're not all perfect. We have our little things that get under people's skin. And if we recognize that in us, let us recognize that in others and not make big things over little things. Verse 6 and verse 7. It does not rejoice at wrongdoing, but rejoices with the truth. Love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. What's the point from this passage? Deal with the person and work it out in truth. Let truth reign in these communications that you have. If it's a major thing that is bothering you, go to the person and work it out in truth. Don't let it escape your lips to another ear before you confront the person that you need to deal with it. It says that this type of action rejoices in truth. It doesn't rejoice in a critical attitude. Verse 8, point number 3. Love never ends. Love never ends. What does this tell us? In all things and in all dealings, practice love. Love will cover a multitude of sins. It will stop you from saying things that you ought not to say. It will stop from having a critical attitude begin in your heart and fester to other parts of your life. And so in all things, we practice love. And there's your 9 points. 3 facts of criticism, how it affects us and how it affects those close to us. 3 ways to identify it. If things are done without love, it's a critical spirit. And 3 ways to control it. Let love reign in your heart. Thank you for your time, and I hope that these points are practical that help you. I know that I deal with these situations in my life all the time, and I hope that they help you in yours.